This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America, your source for Pan-African news and world developments. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehis Wuhib. Coming up on Africa News Tonight,
the issue of domestic violence has come to the fore in Uganda after a member of parliament argued in favor of wife beating.
That's Salima Tumani reporting from Kampala. Full details coming up.
Also, a group advocating for the return of girls kidnapped by Boko Haram is threatening to sue the Nigerian government. And the Libyan government has issued arrest warrants for 205 people accused of involvement in a human smuggling ring.
We'll have these stories and lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story, the issue of domestic violence has come to the fore in Uganda after a member of parliament argued in favor of wife beating. Halima Athmani has the story from Kampala.
In the words of the Ugandan legislator, a man who disciplines his wife can touch, tackle, and beat her to streamline her. Onesmus Twinamatsko, a member of national parliament, made the comments to a national TV outlet on March 8th. Outraged, the public demanded an apology. This is what they got on the floor of parliament Wednesday.
Kindly accept my sincere and unreserved apologies, honorable members. And the general public, and more particularly the women, this apology is unconditional. The beating I met wasn't the normal beating.
In other media interviews this week, Twinamatsiko reportedly said certain forms of abuse like slapping are okay. Female legislator Adeke Anne Ebaju is among the MPs demanding disciplinary action against their colleague.
There was no remorse in his statement. He still made mention of a certain beating in quotes, which he did not even explain. And whatever explanation he attaches to it, I think it still belittles women. Did you see how all the male colleagues were thumping when he spoke about a certain beating?
VOA was not able to obtain recent government statistics on spousal abuse. However, a 2011 demographic and health survey is telling. It found that about 3 in 5 women in Uganda believe that wife beating is justified. This is despite laws such as the Constitution and the Domestic Violence Act, which outlaw such abuse. On International Women's Day, March 8th, Uganda's President Yoweri Museveni had highlighted the issue and passed a stern warning.
Men who are cowards are the ones who beat women. Why do you beat women? Why don't you, if you want to fight, why don't you look for fellow men and you fight? Why do you beat somebody who is weak?
The reasons women cited for beatings, according to the 2011 survey, included going out without permission, neglecting the children, arguing back, refusing to have sex, or banning the food. VOA spoke to Tina Musuya, the executive director of Center for Domestic Violence Prevention in Kampala.
All those who still think that a man must be the head of the household think they are privileged to discipline them. So many of them think that when someone does that, it is an expression of love. And when the victims come out to seek for support, they are blamed and told to, you know, there's no good man out there, just hang in there, pray about it, he will one day change.
Local activists viewed Winamasiko's comments as a setback. They said the narrative needs to change on domestic violence in Uganda, with perpetrators being held accountable, not excused. Halima Athmani for VOA News, Kampala.
In Nigeria, a group advocating for the return of kidnapped girls is threatening to sue the government. Boko Haram militants took 110 schoolgirls from the northeastern town of Dapchi in late February. They kidnapped 276 girls from the town of Chibok 2 years earlier. The group Bring Back Our Girls is asking the government of Muhammadu Buhari to explain why security had been removed from the town despite protections guaranteed under a Safe Schools initiative established in 2014. The group's leader said if the government does not respond, it will sue the government for gross negligence. After the attack on Dapchi, the government first said there was no evidence of abduction. Later, it said, falsely, that more than 70 girls had been returned. Reporter Isaac Linus was recently in Dapchi and spoke to some of the girls who hid from the Boko Haram attackers. He spoke to VOA's William Eagle about what he learned.
They told them, okay, we are soldiers, please come in, come enter these vehicles, we're here to save you. So this very girl that I spoke with, she was with the hostel security man. So he told the girls, that the ones that were close to him, that they should not jump into that vehicle. But unfortunately, some of them kept on entering the vehicle. So the ones that were close to him, so he pushed them aside, and that's how they ran into the forest. And they slept in the forest and came back to the school the next day in the morning.
How are these girls doing today?
One of the girls was injured per se. We are talking about the ones that have escaped. None of them was injured. But of course, they are still in shock. Basically, they are still in trauma. They are still thinking about their friends. They are still thinking about some of their had siblings that got missing.
Did you also speak with the parents?
Yes, the parents are not happy. On the day that the girls were missing, a day later that the governor's spokesman announced on the radio that the girls have been found and that he was coming to reunite them back with these girls. And that was 3 days later. So by the time he did, on the day that, so the whole town was in jubilation that the girls have been found. So by the time he came, when he got to the village, unfortunately, he told them that the girls were not found, that he thinks that the girls are not with Boko Haram, as every trace on the route that the Boko Haram passed through, that they followed the road and they didn't find the girls with the Boko Haram. So his thinking was that the girls most probably had fled into the bush, the forest. So when he said that, there are a lot of women that just fell down unconsciously and they had to be taken to the hospital. This girl's mother that I spoke to, that it was after like 5 or 7 days that I spoke to her, you could still see that she was still in trauma. You know, I met her, she was praying using her beads, this Islamic beads she was praying. And according to her, basically what they are depending on is God, that God should come out and help them.
Is it true that there was no security at the school?
Yes, it's true that there was no security. First of all, the army had released a statement because the governor said it was because the military people were pulled out. That was why they attacked. After the military people were pulled out, then Boko Haram went in to do this attack. So he blamed it on the military. The military also put out a statement that was last week to say that they had secured the town. And after securing the town, that they had handed over the town. Since they felt that there was peace, they felt that there was no threat, security threat to Dutchie, so they handed over to the police. The police also immediately put out a statement denying that the military never handed over Chibok to them. You know, so it's basically a blame game.
Is there security now in the village?
Yes, there are two military checkpoints just right in front of the gate of the school right now. And also there is a military checkpoint just before Chibok, where the police used to be.
How is this issue now affecting politics or even perhaps the popularity of the Buhari government?
Before this attack, you know, people have agreed, even when the president and his military chiefs have said that they've technically defeated Boko Haram. But with this attack now, with this abduction, it has taken away everything that this administration has done in terms of security-wise. People are feeling very angry. A lot of people are feeling that Buhari has not done anything. And of course, the opposition party, being the PDP, the People's Democratic Party, were just toppled in the 2015 election. Of course, they are saying that he does not have the capacity to rule this country because as a military man, this is supposed to be one of his primary strengths. So it's really going to be something that is going to be a factor that he has to really deal with in 2019. I think it's going to work against him.
That was reporter Isaac Linus in Abuja, Nigeria. He was speaking to VOA's William Eagle.
Nigerians who live outside the country are working to make their voices heard in next year's presidential election. The diaspora rights movement is fighting for the right of the 17 million Nigerian expats to vote. The group, formed in 2003, has branches in the United Kingdom, Africa, U.S., Scandinavia, and Asia. It's behind a campaign for an amendment to Nigeria's constitution that would allow those who live abroad to cast ballots. Lawa Ayula is the chairman of the group of Nigerians living in Sweden, Denmark, Norway, and Finland. Reporter Mike Mbonye asked him to elaborate on the group's goals.
This group is agitating for not just people residing in the diaspora. We basically categorize them into four groups. One, the workers. Two, the internally displaced people. And three, certain professionals, such as the military personnel, public officials or diplomats, and their families. The fourth group are the citizens living temporarily or permanently outside Nigeria.
When did the agitation for diaspora voting commence? Why do they deserve to vote? Who are you lobbying in Nigeria or abroad for the right to vote?
The agitation started more than a decade ago. There's been progress about the diaspora commission, diaspora rights. However, the voting rights has been excluded. One of the key promises during the election was a diaspora vote coming on board in 2019. However, we are still waiting for the ruling party to live by their words. However, we have some legislators on board with us, such as the Honorable Gbajabi Amila, who is also a diasporan. He has given his own perspective on the way to go about it, which made us to know emphatically that he's about constitutional amendment. We know that the Senate committee, a chairperson on diaspora matters and NGOs, non-governmental organization, in the name of Nadia Boros, she has been very, very active and very involved in ensuring that the diaspora vote comes to pass.
Do you have an idea why successive governments in Nigeria have not approved diaspora voting? Is it expense or is it likely that diaspora voters would vote against the sitting government?
We're basically talking about why the successive government in Nigeria have not approved diaspora voting. It tends to be more an issue of a constitutional amendment. And I tend to believe that maybe then we have not done enough. We have not done enough. Enough agitation have not been made to make sure that we are on spot. We tend to realize that we are included in the entire system. And we tend to realize that this issue is an issue of constitutional amendment.
Do you think diaspora voting will make the difference in any Nigerian election?
I personally believe, and the group specifically believe, that the diaspora vote will make a huge difference in any election in Nigeria. In the sense that we are very exposed. We are living in an advanced country where things are working and good governance and democracy are in top gear. And we tend to think of replication of such in our own land. Thereby, if we are involved in this election, if we are given the right to vote, it means that there will be more scrutiny in the caliber and the type of the people that will be in governance. Indirectly or directly, it's going to have a direct impact on how the country is governed.
Lawa Ayula is the chairman of the Diaspora Rights Movement. He spoke with reporter Mike Mbonye.
A week before U.S. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson was fired, 10 U.S. senators sent him a letter expressing concern over reported intimidation and detention of the main opposition candidates for Egypt's coming presidential election. The senators made several requests, including a frank assessment of the credibility of Egypt's electoral process and whether all citizens will be able to participate freely. Experts say it is unclear how Tillerson's sudden departure may affect the senators' requests. From Washington, reporter Mohammed El-Shenawi has the story.
The letter is signed by 10 of the most influential members of the United States Senate from both parties, including John McCain, chairman of the Armed Services Committee, and Tim Kaine of the Foreign Relations Committee. While the senators acknowledge that Egypt remains a critical U.S. strategic partner, they argued that without progress on the political front, the country's security and economic gains will be unsustainable. The senators asked for a State Department assessment of the human rights situation in Egypt, including the rights to freedom of association, peaceful assembly, and freedom of expression. Egyptian Minister of Parliamentary Affairs Omar Marwan said Wednesday that Egypt has taken numerous steps to move forward, only to be hit with more false allegations on human rights. The fate of the senators' requests is unclear due to the State Department's unsettled situation with President Donald Trump nominating CIA Director Mike Pompeo to replace Tillerson. Andrew Miller is a former director of Egyptian affairs at the United States National Security Council. He says Pompeo may find ways to make the relationship work.
We can't rule out the possibility, but those underlying differences where the United States and Egypt are not on the same side are going to continue to assert themselves. So he may want to take the relationship in a different direction, but he's not going to find necessarily a ready-made audience for that. And it's possible that the professionals, if he listens to them at the State Department, could play a role in restraining those temptations.
Miller says whether Pompeo responds to the letter or not, the 10 senators will likely continue to pressure the issues of the election in the largest Arab country and improving the human rights environment. Critics say Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi has increasingly undermined rights heading into the election.
So even though the letter is addressed to Secretary Tillerson, I think that the new Secretary of State will also take heed of that letter, and there will be an effort by those same senators to engage with the administration, to engage with the State Department, with the new Secretary of State, to ensure that the issues and questions posed in that letter are factored into U.S. policy vis-a-vis Egypt.
Michelle Dunn, Director of Middle East Program at Carnegie Endowment for International Peace, agrees that the letter is still valid and may get the requested assessments. She also says the U.S. cannot affect major change in Egyptian politics. However, she says certain U.S. policy decisions could indicate dissatisfaction with the reported human rights violations in Egypt.
We saw last year for the first time that the administration actually has withheld some of the military assistance from Egypt. On that basis, the United States should be very careful that its assistance is not directly used in human rights abuses, which there is evidence that it has been used.
Several experts on the region say that regardless of who runs the State Department, Congress can try to link foreign aid to preserving basic freedoms. For VOA News, Mohammed El-Shinawi, Washington.
Libya's Attorney General's office has issued arrest warrants for 205 people accused of involvement in a human smuggling ring. Sidik Al-Sor, the head of the prosecutor's investigations office, says the suspects include members of the security forces, workers at migrant shelters, and employees at some African embassies. He says the charges against them include rape, torture, and murder. The investigation was carried out with the Italian government. Since the fall of Libyan leader Muammar Gaddafi in 2011, the nation has been racked by violence with competing groups seeking control of the government. Hundreds of thousands of migrants, mostly from Africa, have taken advantage of the chaos to use Libya as a jump-off point to cross the Mediterranean to Europe. People smugglers often charge migrants thousands of dollars to go to Europe, but many wind up trapped in Libya and subject to abuses. Tens of thousands have died in the attempt to reach Europe.
For over a decade, the so-called Red Plus framework has worked to prevent deforestation in developing countries such as the Democratic Republic of the Congo. The pact also is intended to safeguard the rights of the indigenous peoples who depend on and care for the forests. However, a report released today by the Rights and Resources Initiative, or RRI, says that in the DRC, indigenous peoples have been sidelined in Red Plus projects. VOA's Adam Phillips reports.
The new report focuses on 20 Red Plus programs in the remote Mayondombe province of the Democratic Republic of the Congo. It contains the world's second largest rainforest and is home to 70,000 indigenous people. Marine Gauthier, one of the report's authors, says those 20 projects were designed to reduce emissions and reduce poverty among the locals.
It's actually failing to address both objectives. It cannot prove any positive impact on deforestation, and it's threatening further communities' land rights. So what we are showing in this report is that the whole approach of this REDD+ program should be changed.
Rainforests extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere and release oxygen. When forests are cleared, that carbon dioxide goes back into the air and contributes to global warming. Gauthier says that both rainforest conservation and community land rights are key to addressing climate change. In her view, the indigenous peoples of the rainforests are ideal stewards of the forests because they traditionally have taken only what they need for food, medicine, and shelter, and have replenished the forests as needed.
But indigenous peoples' forests are being threatened by external investments. They are being threatened, as we know, by natural resources extraction, mining, industrial logging, infrastructure developments.
The financial donors that helped fund the REDD+ programs in Mayo-Dombe province are committed to slowing climate change. And by conserving rainforests, they hope to profit from the sale of carbon credits to companies that produce more than their share of the greenhouse gases that contribute to global warming. Indigenous groups were supposed to share in this bounty. But Gauthier says that these groups have been left out of the planning and implementation process.
What we found doing this report is that indigenous peoples are not involved in those programs. Those programs were planned very far from the field and without indigenous peoples' involvement. They do not empower them and they do not answer to the real issues on the ground, probably because the donors rushed and they were pressured to actually invest and fight climate change because it's an urgent matter. But it doesn't mean that we should find a solution at the expense of indigenous peoples' rights.
The report recommends that instead of top-down planning, where outsiders design the REDD+ projects and dictate how they are administered, forest dwellers should lead the design and implementation of the programs.
And that donors should actually put on hold all types of investments in the Mayo-Dombe and secure communities' land rights prior to any further investments so that they can redesign the whole approach and make sure that this program is a success.
Gauthier adds that it's not too late either to save the rainforests or to ensure that proper land rights for indigenous peoples are respected. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. Please stay tuned to the Sunny Side of Sports coming up at 18:30 UTC. On behalf of our producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, Rob McLean, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. This is James Butte, host of Voice of America's Daybreak Africa. Join me Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC for the latest in African news, features, and sports. We are also available on the internet at www.voaafrica.com. That's Daybreak Africa, your breakfast show on the Voice of America.
VOA Africa has built a successful, effective social media strategy through Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, and other digital platforms. We are responding to our audience on the African continent and in the global diaspora. We believe in the power of connection and interaction to bring you news that is comprehensive, accurate, and objective. We see the changes in technology as an opportunity to engage with our audiences about the issues that affect them. At VOA Africa, we don't just report the news, we help shape the conversation on the continent. VOA, your trusted source for news and information.
Are you suffering from heartache? No problem. We've got the cure for you. The African beat can soothe your heartache with its awesome tunes from the African continent. So join me, David Vandy, Mondays through Fridays at 0900 and 2000 Universal Time for a healing journey. I guarantee it.